The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 1996, the journalist Gail Sheehy came out to Yellow Springs on book tour and did an interview in the Book Nook. Gail died a year ago at the age of 83, and I have been looking for this tape ever since. I have done other interviews with Gail, but I could not find this particular tape, and this is the one that I wanted to play to remember her by, because it's the only time she actually came to the station. And I didn't realize then what a big deal that was, because her book, New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time, had come out the previous year, and then it was reissued in paperback. And she did five cities on her book tour, big cities, cities like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and that fifth city was Dayton, Ohio. Pretty amazing. She came out to the station and she had an entourage with her. And I still didn't realize what a big deal this was, but it really was. Let's revisit my interview now with Gail Sheehy, who died a year ago, on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
New Passages. I know many of our listeners read Passages 20 years ago, and here we are two decades later, and you had intended to write this a few years ago, but you kind of took a detour because you hit the subject of menopause and you ended up with a different book.
Yes, actually, I hit a black hole of ignorance, which didn't even have a name, and to my astonishment, not only did women not talk to their mothers about this phase of life that every woman goes through, they didn't talk to their doctors. Their doctors routinely didn't mention it to them. They didn't even talk to one another. My female friends and I did. I remember sitting at a kitchen table with a girlfriend and saying, you know, have you gotten anywhere near menopause? And she said, oh, me? I'm too young for that. And there was the bottle of Premarin sitting right behind her on the kitchen shelf. So it was kind of overtaking the research for a book that meant to look at the entire adult life cycle anew. So I felt I had to stop, deal with that particular subject, both personally as a woman going through it, and then as a way to open a conversation that I thought was really essential.
Gail Sheehy is my guest, and I think we need to maybe set a little background for folks. I know you sold over 8 million copies of Passages, and for those two or three people out there who aren't familiar with this particular book, let's tell them about it.
Well, this is a book I published 20 years ago, which the subtitle of it was Passages. The subtitle was Predictable Crises of Adult Life. And the thesis was that, like going through the terrible twos and the noisy nines and developmental stages that we all accept, we continue to go through stages of development in adult life. The ages are much more varied, but there are chronologically based changes in our perspective, in the way we look upon ourselves and others, the sense of safeness or danger we have in our life, our sense of time. We have all the time in the world ahead. Have we begun counting our birthdays backwards? and the sense of aliveness and stagnation. And in between the more stable stages, there are these times of disequilibrium and change where we're almost shedding an old skin, and we need to shed an old skin in order to be yeasty and embryonic again. And those are the periods of transition I called passages.
And Passages ends at the age 50.
Well, that book ended at the age 50 because I was in my mid-30s when I began that research, and I frankly thought that there weren't any passages after 50. I mean, clearly I thought it was all downhill from there. And for many people 20 years ago, that was the case. When our parents turned 50, we thought they were old. And usually they thought they were old. Society told them they were old, and they acted old. In just those two decades, though, there has been a revolution in the adult life cycle. And that's what I discovered when I began doing hundreds of interviews with people, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. And what seemed to be pervasive was that people are taking much longer to grow up. First adulthood doesn't really start until about 30 today. And much, much longer to grow old. And that has the effect of kind of elasticizing the whole life cycle. There's no longer a standard life cycle, particular ages when we must do particular things. And ultimately, it has the effect of shifting all the stages of adult life ahead by up to 10 years. So that when I would interview people in their 40s, boomers, facing the big 5-0, none of them would admit to middle age. It simply didn't define them. And in many ways, they're right, because they were on a delay. They had the longest adolescence in the history of the world. Many of them in their 40s still feel that they want to hang on to that kid in themselves. They're much more knowledgeable about their bodies, about what they eat, about fitness. And in fact, we've added 30 years to the human lifespan, the adult lifespan, in just this century alone. So people who, I mean, for 200 years or so, the ages of 19 at the beginning and 60 or 65 at the end pretty much circumscribed the adult lifespan in everybody's minds. And we still carry around those maps. There have been national studies showing that baby boomers still hope that they will retire in their 50s. Well, if you're going to have parents or a parent or an in-law who is going to be arguing with you about whether or not to go into the rest home at 85 or 90, and you have a kid who is going to be moving back and forth in and out of graduate school and moving home up until 30, and you want to start a new life in your 50s when you tie up your main, say, corporate career, you aren't going to be able to retire and hang up the gloves at 55. You're going to need to be working for probably another 30 years. Or so, 20 years, anyway.
So people are confronting new things. These are things that were never confronted before in the history of humankind.
That's really true. And in some ways, we may have actually broken the evolutionary code with all of the biotech discoveries that we're making, drugs that, hormones that replace sustenance that our body used to make for itself when we were younger. And in the very near future, as I've recently reported on, we will be using the body as its own drugstore, if you will, finding various proteins that repair and maintain body tissue, and manipulating genes before diseases occur. So even now, some of the predictions that I found and put into New Passages are pretty startling. I mean, for instance, the best epidemiologists tell me that a woman who reaches age 50 today and remains free of cancer and heart disease can expect to see her 92nd birthday. Hmm. Now, nobody ever prepared us for the possibility we might live long enough to forget the name of our first husband. And men, too, are living much longer than they expected. A man who reaches age 65 today, having passed through the main danger zone for heart attacks, just the average guy, can expect to live to the age of 81. So if you begin to think about the fact that they're also predicting that about half of baby boomers will move into their 80s and 90s, and about a million will live past 100. So think about the idea that you can probably live long enough to see your grandchildren go bald.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to 1996, my interview with Gail Sheehy for her book, New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time. We'll continue with that interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 1996 interview with Gail Sheehy talking about her book, New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time.
Gail, you were doing the research on this book, and you were going to do a chapter on menopause, and then you realized you needed to write an entirely different book about menopause.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think menopause is just something that happens to women. In the new book, you talk about male menopause, and I'm sure a lot of men listening out there are saying, there's no such thing. It just can't happen.
Right. Well, it's a really bad term. Of course, it's a misnomer because men's reproductive organs don't stop functioning all around the same age the way women's do, and it has very little to do with reproduction in men. But there is, it's a shorthand, and people generally have some hint of what we're talking about. What I mean by that, it's a mind-body syndrome that whereby a man begins to lose some vitality and perhaps some virility and a general lowering in his sense of well-being that begins to creep up on many men in their 50s and certainly in their 60s. The most recent study of sexual health in men since the Kinsey Report, the Massachusetts Male Aging Study, reported that half of men between age 40 and 65 experience some level of middle life impotence. Well, it's usually presented by physicians, if they talk about it at all, in just in terms of pathology, whereas it's a really a much larger ball of wax, if you will. There is the hormonal component. It's true that testosterone levels do decline with age in fairly clear proportion, but there are other hormones that decline with age in both men and women. The most recent one that I've been researching is DHEA. I won't even attempt to give you the long form of that term, but it is a master hormone that rises at times when our body is in high growth, just before birth or at puberty, and which declines absolutely routinely with age. And it governs a lot about metabolism and the production of sex hormones. So we're finding more and more that there is a kind of a winding down of the whole machinery that keeps the body metabolizing food and giving us energy, as well as governing our sex drive. So there's that component. Then there's the social component. Today in middle life, men are much more insecure. Their lives are much more unpredictable than they've ever been before, because those who bought the social contract that said if you give your loyalty to a company for 30 years, you'll be rewarded, you'll be in the command phase of your life in your 50s, and you can retire when you wish. Of course, that contract has been torn up in most cases. And so many men in their 50s find their companies thinking of themselves as expensive and expendable. And suddenly they're being offered packages or literally paid to go away. And when I interview these men, I call them corporate refugees, they're just bereft of meaning and identity in life. They don't know where to turn. They did everything they were supposed to do, and now they're not appreciated. Their family, their wives resent having to become the breadwinner. The kids don't even want to talk to them about financial decisions because they're not in charge of it anymore. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't recover and make a good passage into second adulthood. I write about those pacesetters who have faced exactly this crisis and who have found their way out of it, and it actually has become, you know, the generator that has given them a real new start in life.
So you offer some other terms for male menopause, terms like viropause.
Yeah, but that again is just a neologism. It was made up by a Harley Street doctor. Another man, when I was being interviewed in England, called up and said, I'm 45 and I'm feeling like I've been striving all my first adulthood and just climbing up that hill and providing for my family, and now my teenage kids aren't even interested in me. I can see them leaving in another couple of years. I just figure out, what was it all for? I'm probably going right downhill after this, and in another 20 years I'll be a vegetable. My wife says I'm going through manopause. Well, I said, you know what? I really think this has nothing to do with manopause. This is just a plain, the death of first adulthood, the death of that young illusionary self and all that striving where you were supposed to get to the peak and reach your goal and all your dreams come true in your 40s. And even if they do come true, there still is a meaning crisis for most people between 45 and 50. Because now it's not just enough to perform for the outside world, to keep packaging and putting out this false self that gains us rewards and approval from the external world. Now you really want some inner satisfaction. What's the meaning in what I do? Am I living out my values and principles? Am I living with the people that I really value? And am I being connected to them? And then new issues come up for both men and women that initiate, I think, at about 45 to 50, the infancy of a whole second adulthood.
You have a wonderful quote in the book. It says, quote, "The secret in the search for meaning is to find your passion and pursue it."
I'm glad you chose that, Vic, because if I were to boil down the message of the book to one simplistic phrase, that would be the one I'd choose. It's not easy. So many people say, well, do I have a passion? Did I ever have it? What was it? We become so used to kind of moving along in lockstep, doing what we're supposed to do and being responsible that particularly men, I think, don't think of giving themselves permission to say, what do I really want to do? But that's really the secret. And I suggest that people take the time flies test. Just kind of close your eyes and just instinctively, first thing comes to your mind, ask yourself, what did you do when you were a kid where time flew and you didn't even know it? Because somewhere in that activity is probably the kernel of a dormant self that you might be able to bring to the surface and either get education about or practice as a kind of a peon or a disciple at the foot of some experienced person. You probably have to do it on the sidelines for a while you're continuing to do whatever your earning job requires. And it may have nothing to do with career. It may be a spiritual direction. It may be an artistic direction. It may mean that you want to do poetry writing. Don't ever expect to be, Carl Sandburg, but writing poetry allows you to open a chamber in yourself that is very, very important.
Gail Sheehy is my guest. You did extensive research for this book, and your survey instrument, I think, is worth the price of the book just for people to do that survey themselves. You found out so many interesting things. I was amazed at the number of older men who live at home with their families, with their parents.
Or younger men. You mean older men, 25 to 34. Yeah, they're not kids anymore. And then one-third of American young men between 25 and 34 are living at home, albeit perhaps temporarily or in and out. But that's an extraordinary social change. And what that's going to mean in terms of how easily they separate from mom and what they expect from their wives is yet to be seen, but I think it's going to be a very important change.
Let's talk about midlife crises.
Well, you know, the classic early midlife crisis is still with us. People who, say, turn 40, roughly, glimpse mortality. Oh, my God, I actually could die. That does come as quite a shock, and it may happen when you go to a college reunion or high school reunion, and suddenly you say, what are all these old people doing here? Or it may happen because of the result of a death of a friend of the same age or a sudden enfeeblement of a parent or just pulling a muscle. You've been a runner every day, and all of a sudden you pull a muscle, and it takes 3 days to heal instead of a day. That often gives vent to a lot of kind of crazy behavior and buying the sports car, you know, running around with the young floozy. We know all of those symptoms. But what I focus on in this book is something that I think is a little newer, and it's part of the response to this delay in growing up and growing older. I don't think it is until about 45 or 48 or even 50 that boomers today get to the realization that they're really approaching something they probably never planned for. They never thought they'd be other than kind of, you know, the young kid in the block, mm-hmm. or at least part of the youth revolution. Now they're going to be part of the adult revolution. They're going to redefine middle age. And as I told you, they don't accept that term. They're just not having it. So I came up with something else that I think describes a lot of them in transition. They're in middlescence. Kind of adolescence the second time around, but with everything maybe a half an inch lower. And again, you have to ask yourself, well, what do I want to do now that I've really grown up? how can I customize my life cycle, my life from this time on? You know, first adulthood just happens to us. We're so busy getting from A to B to C. But second adulthood, we have the opportunity to custom design because there is no longer a standard life cycle. And who do I want to share it with? Or am I prepared to go this stage of life alone? You know, a lot of women between mid-40s and mid-50s today who are divorced are making that decision. They're more reluctant to get remarried than divorced men of the same age. Why? Because they don't want to go back to the old deal. They'd like to have, many of them, a partner to share intellectual, emotional, recreational, sexual needs and interests with, but they're not going to go back to being, submerging their own needs and intentions to an old marriage contract. Men in middle life who are unattached are a pretty sorry lot. There's a whole chapter in the book about these guys who got together every Friday night in a fish house in one particular group and talked about how tough it is to have nobody to come home to between 6 and 8 who makes a big fuss over you. No kids running around saying, oh, gee, Daddy, isn't he wonderful, and no wife to provide the comforts. And many of them will just go off to a health club in order to kind of murder the time when they used to be the center of attention. And now we find out that even scientific studies show that men between 45 and 65 who are married, doesn't count if you're just living with a woman, but if they were married, have a 50% greater chance of living 10 years longer than men who are not married during those ages.
Those are scary figures. So if you're an unattached male out there, go find somebody. Things have really changed for people in their 40s, in their 50s, in their 60s. What are some of the most interesting things that you discovered in your research about these age ranges?
Well, I talk about the flourishing 40s, and one of the stark changes is that when I wrote the original passages, men at that time would routinely say, if they'd been married for 15 or 20 years, you know, I've grown, but my wife just hasn't. And hence, there would often be a divorce in midlife. Now it's the women saying it. Gee, I've grown so much, and my husband just hasn't kept up. Now, why is that? It seems to me over the last 20 years, women have changed really drastically. Doors have been opened, pride opened. They have been on a very steep trajectory in learning and experience and exhilaration, finding their new powers. And men have been developing at a normal rate, doing what they've pretty much always done. And so very often you have this disparity, and people really hate to give up. The husband might be a best friend, but just isn't quite as on the same level. So you get this reversal of what I used to write about 20 years ago with men. On the other hand, I do want to hasten to add that men are not a lost cause by a long shot. And I find, as I travel around the country and do group interviews with men, that more and more often, small groups of men who I kind of identify, a little friendship circle, they may be men that they work with, they may be just men they've met through perhaps church or social activities, are getting together in small groups and really talking from the gut and meeting regularly and getting each other through the divorces, the downsizing, the inevitable assaults of aging, losing hair.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community, revisiting an interview I did 25 years ago with Gail Sheehy, who died last year. We talked about her book, New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time. And I'll continue my conversation with Gail Sheehy from 1996 right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO back in 1996. The journalist Gail Sheehy came out to Yellow Springs to record an interview for her book, New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time. Let's listen now to the conclusion of my conversation with Gail Sheehy.
Gail Sheehy is my guest, and New Passages is the book, just out in a trade paperback. I'm sure everybody out there is waiting for us to get to this subject. Let's talk about sex. How is it different now for people going into these ages?
Well, first of all, there's a lot more of it. you know, this was a very curious thing. The major sex survey that was done last year, I think it was the largest one since the Kinsey Report, guess what age it stopped asking questions? At age 60.
Mm.
Now, think of the bias of those researchers. I mean, do they think everybody just kind of dries up and starts knitting booties or going to the golf course at 60? I beg to differ with them. There's actually a resurgence of sexual desire in the part of many women, particularly in the postmenopausal period. There's a little kicker of testosterone in their hormone cocktail because the estrogen level is so much reduced, and there's an uninhibited quality. Women in their 50s, I call them today, I name that period the flaming 50s, because not only are they hot some of the time from hot flashes, but they're also just kind of taking off with a tremendous afterburn into fields and of endeavor where women haven't been represented much before. They're in state legislatures, they're in the arts, they're making movies, they're in town government, they're newspapering, they're doing all kinds of things. So often they recapture that kind of adventurous young woman who pre-puberty really wasn't inhibited about her sexuality and was, you know, climbing trees and taking chances. Mm-hmm. Now, men will often find that the changes in their sexual desire that inevitably creep up in the 50s or 60s, very frightening. As a sign that they're over the hill, that they are no longer the Samson that they thought that they were as young men. But if they know that this is natural and temporary and can be corrected, can be delayed, it may require in some instances hormone replacement therapy if they are having a very precipitous drop in testosterone. But more likely, it's probably a matter of physical health of the organism. And anything that blocks blood and oxygen going to the heart and that, you know, precipitates heart disease interrupts blood and oxygen to the sex organs and interrupts that flow. So it's the inevitable consequence of freaking out over change that is natural can be a midlife impotence. So I think we're just beginning now to educate men to the normal changes that occur so that they don't make the mistake of counting themselves out. And I think we're finding that people in their 70s and even 80s, widows and widowers, are often remarrying today, sometimes to their childhood sweethearts, and then scandalizing their middle-aged children. And I know some instances just among friends of mine where a man in his 80s who had lost his wife and everybody thought this would be absolutely the end of the road for him and physical problems occurred, and he made contact with his childhood high school sweetheart and finally lured her to come back to town. And the next thing you know, he proposed to her and they've set up house and he had to have a leg amputated, but it hardly stopped him because he's so filled with a lust for life and for the love of his life.
Such a beautiful story when you hear about something like that. People discovering a sweetheart. I can remember my grandfather who had lost his wife, and he was contacted by a woman he dated in high school when he was in his 80s, and he moved into the retirement community right down the hall from her. And they were together until she passed away a few years later, and it was just so sweet to see that.
Very tender, very precious.
What's next for you, Gail? Are you working on anything else?
Well, I'm working on something really exciting, Vic. After a couple of years of effort, a little group of us has gotten together a TV special, or we're in the process of doing it, that will be shown based on New Passages in prime time on ABC on August 26th. And it will be a two-hour show showing different people around the country who are living through these passages, through this new territory of second adulthood, and some in first adulthood, and how different the world looks through their eyes. And we hope that people will see themselves reflected in those life stories and feel a little bit better located in this map of adult life.
That's a tremendous validation of your work to have a television program of that sort produced based on what you've done. Gail, when you go out and you meet your public, what's it like for you? Is it exhausting? Is it delightful? What's it like?
Well, it can be exhausting, but I'm always buoyed by meeting people in the flesh at lectures or at bookstore events. First of all, I'm thrilled that bookstores are doing so well and that their stock is rising. That means that people are still reading, and reading almost more avidly than ever, which challenges all the hype that we hear about the internet. I like the internet too, don't get me wrong, but I never want people to stop reading. I think you get a whole different experience from actually reading a book. And the second thing is that I love hearing people's stories. I mean, I have an insatiable appetite for hearing people's stories. And I'm happy when people come up and talk to me and tell me a little bit about where they are or where they've been or something that connected for them in the book and what they've done with it.
You mentioned a little while ago thinking about what it is that you do, that you feel a passion for, that makes it seem like there's no time passing. And for me, in my life, being able to talk to people like you, we've been talking for a half hour. I feel like you just walked in the door, and this is my passion. This is my pleasure. I enjoy it so much talking to writers like yourself who come through and stop at WYSO. It's just really a pleasure to meet you.
Well, that's so nice of you to say. I feel the same way. I feel very very honored to be able to take on the role of a cultural communicator, if you will, you know, to kind of pass on the word about people's stories and people's lives. But my passion basically is writing. When I'm really into it, after I've gone through all the excuses and all the jitterbug and getting up and down and getting a glass of water and, you know, changing the plant water, to finally sit down at that computer with my thoughts and close the door, I'm gone.
Let's talk for a moment about that time of crisis when people in their mid-40s or whenever it is evaluate their lives and they think, what do I need to do to be happy in my life? Am I happy with where I am right now? Not necessarily a midlife crisis, but that reflection, that evaluation. Do I want to keep doing this? Isn't there something else in my life? You ran into a lot of people that had felt this way.
Exactly. Well, to generalize, with men, often the issue really is moving from thinking to feeling, from outer to inner, because men and male animals, you know, for centuries in their youth are pretty much narrowly directed. They're seeking territory, gaining territory, hunting, hunting for promotions, competing, so on. As they get to middle life, their connections with other people, nurturing and being nurtured, becomes more important. One of the things that has startled me was how often men in interviews would talk about their anguish over empty nest. Because just at the point when they were ready to turn back to the kids are, I'm out of here, Dad. Sorry, I don't really need you to play basketball with us anymore. You know, got the guys. More often I've heard this anguish from men than I did from their wives, who are ready to go out and do something else. So what I finally boiled it down to after hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questionnaire surveys and hundreds of interviews was that men, to make the shift into the age of mastery in middle life, need to move from an emphasis primarily on competing to connecting. And connecting, I mean connecting emotionally and in a human sense with others. It may be with an estranged father. It may be with children from a first marriage that they haven't really been close to, felt guilty about, haven't contacted. It may be starting a new family as a start-over dad. And it certainly is important to find intimacy and trust and companionship with a mate, because that is one of the real hallmarks of a man who is happy in second adulthood, is that he has the comfort of mature love. Now, for women, it's a different story by and large, although you have to accommodate here because some women, point women in the Vietnam generation, followed pretty much the kind of life cycle and career cycle of men. So for them, it may be as they get into their 40s, if they've never thought about children, if they put that on the back burner, an obsession to have a child takes over. And I write about it, the fantasy of fertility forever, which is one of the problems in our culture now. We've blurred the line of infertility. We've done it with all kinds of technological and devices and fertility drugs, and that's all to the good. But what it does is it allows women to put off the decision and the preparation for motherhood, and often too late. So that then exactly what they hope to avoid, which was, I don't want to be controlled by my biology, is exactly what happens to them in their 40s. And they do it to, they become so obsessed with becoming pregnant that they may neglect a marriage, neglect their career, and those things may not hold up. But for a traditional woman who has spent the first part of her adult life pleasing others, taking care of others, being responsible for others, the real shift in the to the age of mastery is to mastery. And it may start very small with mastery, going back to college, finishing college. There's a million women over the age of 40 in college in the United States. Or it may be going to get an advanced degree, or getting training as a computer technologist, or deciding that you want to be a teacher because you'd really like to still be a nurturer, but in a more professional sense. And that's a career with a lot of longevity. My own sister began her master's degree in teaching at the age of 50. Hmm. Mastery may also be moving into a more managerial direction. So many women in middle life are starting small businesses, their own small businesses, where they can have more flexible hours, they can work 70 hours a week when they need to, and they can shrink it down when it's maybe a family holiday and they want to spend more time with their loved ones. It may be moving into a scientific field. It may be becoming a real intellectual. It may mastering certain intellectual skills. And it's often political. Women, as they age, become, generally speaking, more managerial and political. Today, one quarter of the state legislators in this country are women, and most of them are women in the flaming 50s or beyond.
Gail, I just looked at the clock, and I said to myself, oh, my, you have to go. You have another appointment. I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much for your eloquence. We are so honored that you could come and see us here at WYSO. Thank you so much.
It's been all my pleasure, Vic. Thank you.
And that was Gail Sheehy, recorded 25 years ago. She came out to Yellow Springs to do an interview for her book, New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time. It had just come out in paperback. She only did 5 cities on that book tour, 4 very large cities, and Dayton, Ohio. This is back when Dayton used to attract hundreds of authors every year on book tours. Some of you will recall the Books and Company store in the Town and Country Shopping Center was quite a magnet for writers and readers for many years. And there were years when they probably had a couple of hundred authors come through there in a single year on book tours. And they attracted Gail Sheehy. I'm sure she had a big crowd that night for her book signing. Gail died last year. She died on August 24th, 2020. And I want to share her intriguing obituary from the New York Times. This came out on August 25th, 2020. Gail Sheehy, a journalist who plumbed the interior lives of public figures for clues to their behavior, examined societal trends as signposts of cultural shifts, and most famously illuminated life changes in her book Passages, died at a hospital in Southampton, New York. She was 83. Her daughter, Maura Sheehy, said the cause was complications of pneumonia. Gail Sheehy, a lively participant in New York's literary scene and a practitioner of creative nonfiction, studied anthropology with Margaret Mead. She applied those skills to explore the cultural upheaval of the 1960s and 70s and to gain psychological insights into the newsmakers she profiled, among them Hillary Clinton, Margaret Thatcher, Mikhail Gorbachev, and both Presidents Bush. In articles for Vanity Fair and New York magazines, her specialty was connecting the dots of a biography to show how character was destiny. She was a star writer at New York and later married its co-founder, Clay Felker, who encouraged her to write big stories. In one of her earliest articles, she traveled with Robert F. Kennedy's 1968 presidential campaign. She wrote presciently about subjects that marked turns in the culture, including blended families and drug addiction. Of her 17 books, the most prominent and influential was Passages in 1976, which examined the predictable crises of adult life and how to use them as opportunities for creative change. It sold 10 million copies, was named by the Library of Congress as one of the 10 most influential books of modern times, and remained on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years. As she noted in the book's foreword, most studies of life's mileposts were focused on children and older people, but she wanted to look at those in the vast middle. Quote, "The rest of us are out there in the mainstream of a spinning and distracted society trying to make some sense of our one and only voyage through its ambiguities." But she offered hope to those struggling through middle age, concluding that older is better. Ms. Sheehy built the concept of Passages into a franchise, spinning off more books and articles that examined other stages of life. In 1992, The Silent Passage about menopause, New Passages, the book we discussed in that interview, in 1995, which proclaimed middle age obsolete and explored new options after age 50, and Understanding Men's Passages in 1998. She capped off the theme with two later books. After serving as the primary caregiver for several years for Mr. Felker, who died in 2008 at 82, she wrote Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence in 2010, and in Daring, My Passages, a Memoir in 2014. She wrote about her own life, although many reviewers complained that she was not as revealing as they had hoped she would be. One senses beneath the surface something fascinating to be said about her complicated, ambivalent relationship with feminism, Michelle Goldberg wrote in the New York Times Book Review. At one point, Ms. Goldberg said, she writes of her fear of being linked with radical feminists, quote, angry women whose resentment was turning the sterling silver concept of equal rights into corrosive, man-hating sexual warfare. Yet in the very next paragraph, she says, quote, slow incremental changes were not going to get us anywhere. And how could we show the world we were mounting nothing less than a revolution? Still, over a half century, Ms. Sheehy never lost her appetite for chasing a good story. Whenever you hear about a great cultural phenomenon, a revolution, an assassination, a notorious trial, an attack on the country, drop everything, Ms. Sheehy said in a commencement speech in 2016 at the University of Vermont, her alma mater. Get on a bus or train or plane and go there. Stand at the edge of the abyss and look down into it, she advised. You will see a culture turned inside out and revealed in a raw state. Ms. Sheehy was born on November 27, 1936, and grew up in Mamaroneck, New York, attending public schools. Her mother, Lillian Rainey Hinnian, was a homemaker. Her father, Harold Hinnian, owned an advertising business. Ms. Sheehy graduated from the University of Vermont in 1958 with a bachelor's degree in English and home economics. Her first job was as a consumer representative for J.C. Penney. She married Albert F. Sheehy in 1960 and moved to Rochester, New York, where he attended medical school, and she worked as a fashion coordinator at McCurdy's department store, decorating windows. She then interviewed for a job on the fashion page of the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, though the editor was reluctant to hire her. "He told me he didn't want someone to work just a year and then want a family," she told the Democrat and Chronicle in 2015. "I was very fresh," I said. "I didn't expect a pregnancy exam." She said that in those days, the mid-1960s, women were categorized as either holy mother or frigid career girl. Still, Ms. Sheehy learned some valuable lessons. "The paper taught me to write on deadline and to see it to get the good stories to build a career. I had to get in on it early and have a vision," she said. The couple soon moved back to New York City. They would divorce in the late 1960s, and she landed a job at the New York Herald Tribune in the women's section, or what she called the estrogen department. "One day she snuck down the back stairs into the testosterone zone," she told the Democrat and Chronicle, and only slightly intimidated, approached Mr. Felker, an editor there. She quickly pitched a story about men in Manhattan who held specimen parties using women to bring in more attractive women. He liked the idea and told her to write about it, but write it as a scene. Those few words opened worlds for her. At the time, the Herald Tribune was a hotbed of so-called new journalism in which writers like Tom Wolfe used the tools of novelist characters, dialogue, and scene setting to create compelling narratives. Ms. Sheehy caught on right away and propelled herself off the women's pages to cover some of the biggest events of the time. She snared an exclusive interview with Robert Kennedy just before he was assassinated and wrote profiles of Catholic women in Belfast, Northern Ireland during the sectarian strife that turned into Bloody Sunday. It was in Belfast that the seed for the book Passages was planted. She was talking with a boy there when she wrote, "A bullet blew his face off." She herself nearly took a bullet, a moment that traumatized her and made her think about what she called the arithmetic of life. Ms. Sheehy attended Columbia University on a fellowship and developed her forensic skills, studying there with Margaret Mead. And her articles in New York often caused a sensation. In one in 1972, titled The Secret of Grey Gardens, she revealed the little-known bohemian life of Edith Ewing Bouvier Beale, an aunt of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Miss Beale's daughter, known as Little Edie. Another place was Red Pants and Sugar Man in 1971, about a streetwalker and a pimp, for which Miss Sheehy dressed up as a prostitute to do her reporting. In a disclaimer, she acknowledged that she had made up characters for the article. But Mr. Felker, to her everlasting horror, took out the disclaimer because he thought it slowed down the article. She landed in a heap of trouble for that. Still qualifies as a serious ethical breach. Ms. Sheehy faced other criticisms, accused of practicing armchair psychology and training her eye too often on affluent professionals. Roger Gould, a L.A. psychiatrist, sued her for plagiarism, saying she had made extensive use of his research in Passages without giving him credit. They settled out of court. Ms. Sheehy and Mr. Felker had a tempestuous, passionate, on-again, off-again romance that after many years turned into a stable relationship and in 1984 into a happy marriage. They raised Maura Sheehy from Ms. Sheehy's first marriage and adopted a Cambodian refugee, Mom Sheehy, who had lost most of her family during the murderous Pol Pot regime. At her death, Ms. Sheehy had been working on a book about the millennial generation. Gail Sheehy, she was a force. And you might have heard at the end of that interview, I mentioned that she had an appointment. Imagine my surprise when I found out what that appointment was. She went out into our lobby where she was served a catered lunch, and then she received a massage. And I watched this from the air studio. That was her appointment. Like I say, she had an entourage with her that day, a masseuse, a publicist. It was quite a deal, and I had no clue until I saw that happening what her appointment was. She had an appointment for lunch and a massage. You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. For The Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.